Then some fellow discovered that if you put a lot of potash fertilizer on it, it would be good for 4 more years. Well, then some economist did this. He figured that it cost too much to put potash fertilizer on it. So now last year, at our Ohio State Experimental Station, I think at Worcester, they found that if you put 7 pounds of borax to the acre, that is equivalent to a lot of potash fertilizer, and it's so little that it's hard to put on. So you have to mix it with cornmeal and put it in one of these clover seed kidneys, you see, in order to... Now, down in Florida, they tried to raise tomatoes in the early days up around Lake Okeechobee, where they had 18 feet of the most terrific black soil in the world. And the tomato plants would grow very nicely, blossom, nice green tomato sprout, and it'd fall off. So there was a fellow from up north here, he said, I've been in the tomato business all my life, and you cannot raise tomatoes without your stable manure. So he shipped trainloads of stable manure down there and put it on that perfectly wonderful soil, and sure enough, the tomatoes grew, bloomed, and ripened. He said, they didn't I tell you? Well, now they find 2.5 pounds of manganese dioxide per acre takes the place of a trainload of stable manure, see? I think it's possible, or going to be possible, and I don't know how long. I'm not a very good predictor. But sometime that we ought to be able to raise 3 or 4 times as much off an acre of land as we are today without taking any more out of the soil. Because there's no fixed ratio between the mineralization that is going into the plant and what you eat. So all we need to do is... But we've never done a thing to help these plants out here. They were here millions and millions of years before we got here. And of course, they're no wise interested in people, regardless of how much we're interested in them. And so all they need to do is to turn in and help them a little bit. And I think they'll teach us an awful lot of it. We get into very peculiar things. I've been in this photosynthesis business, and in order to explain what it is, that's why the grass is green business. And the leaf is called chlorophyll, and chlorophyll is the Greek for green leaf. So we don't know any more about it in Greek than we do about it. The plants that we're using, because we can raise them in about 2 weeks, is a little plant called the blue-green alga. Now, your technical department will have a name for those. It's the oldest plant in the world. It goes way back into Precambrian age. It's maybe 2 billion years. And it's been growing the same way. It's the only continuous thing we have with the beginning of plant life. I've been playing with it because it's a very simple plant, and as I say, it grows fast, and you can study it. And it has a beautiful blue material when you extract it. It transmits brilliant blue light, and it reflects a brilliant red light. And that material is called phycocyanin. A friend of mine sent me a little book. And so I read the book, and I said, now here is the answer. So I called some of my boys at Antioch, where we were doing some of this work, and I said, get me the structural formula for phycocyanin. Well, I didn't hear from them for a week or two, and I called them up again. They said, well, nobody knows the formula for phycocyanin. So then I called Brentano's in New York, and wanted to know if they had any more books on it. And I called Crocs up here in Chicago, and wanted to know if they had. And they sent me all the books they had. All were sure that this was phycocyanin, see? Finally, I got back to Dayton. I have one of these Oxford Underbridge dictionaries there. And I thought I'd look it up, although it doesn't specialize in scientific terms. And finally, it was there. And phycocyanin is derived from 2 Greek words. Phyco, meaning alga, and cyanin, meaning blue. And so this phycocyanin is a blue alga, see? This is exactly what we started out with. So if you just happen to know a few Latin and Greek synonyms, you can get away with the neighbors, all right, but you can't get away with the plants. Well, Now the boys are what's called an aerial society. You must have some members here who are making a specialty of growing these little things. And they have a so-called nutrient solution. And that's what the plant's supposed to like. But it has the same characteristic that if you transplant from one bottle to another, to another, to another, to another, after a while it will grow. And then you have to change it, and then it goes all right again. And there's a great argument as to whether it needs certain things or not. Well, I said, why don't we start out and find out? Well, they said 80% of it, and the particular material that we're talking about was boron. And about 80% of them said it didn't need boron, and 20% of them said it did. Well, if you transplant this algae over into a bottle, or into a glass tumbler here that's got some solution in it without any boron, it looks as though the algae grows just as well as it did before. But if you transplant it into another non-boron, and another one, and another one, after about 7 or 8, it won't grow at all anymore. So then how much boron should you add to it to check it out? Well, if you happen to, if you pour this liquid here over into an ordinary glass tumbler, it'll immediately start to grow because it dissolves enough boron out of the glass to go ahead and do it. But if you want to get an actual measure of it, you can start by adding a little boron to the solution in which it doesn't grow. Well, one part in 5 billion, not million, this is up into regular national debt terms, one part in 5 billion of boron, in 3 hours you can see that it started to grow. Well, now that's a very good analysis. Our good spectroscope will only go down to about one part in a billion. And you can make this analysis on your back doorstep, see, because you don't have to know. All you need to do is to measure out a gram of sodium borate and put it into 100 cc's of water and take 1 cc of that and keep on running down until you get one part in a billion, see? If you spill a little, it really don't amount to anything. So what we've always tried to do is to get people to talking to the thing and ask it what it wants. Don't try to edict it. We've had too much of that in engineering. We've drawn something and we wanted the apparatus to work like we designed it. Now, I don't know whether you teach engineering here, but you make the drawing. You get the idea, then you make the drawings, then you make the pieces, then you put it together, and it works. Now, that's the way they taught engineering when I went to school. That's a long while ago. I'm from Ohio State University. And they had that as a perfectly definite thing. You had to make the perfect drawing from the idea, then you made it, and it worked. Now, in the business I've been in for a good many years, the last thing we do is make the drawings. We get the machine to work first, and then we get to make the drawings of the way it works, which introduces the problem of experimental evaluation. There are some educational institutions which don't like the inventor type of procedure. They say, well, you're one of those cut-and-try artists. I said, no, we don't cut-and-try. We experimentally evaluate, experimentally evaluate, experimentally evaluate, which is quite a different thing. Dr. Willard and I were talking about these equations with the constant K's in them, see? You can write these beautiful differential equations with a constant K in. Well, now, we experimentally determine the value of the constant K, see? And after you got that, you don't need the other part of the equation anyhow. But what I would like to point out, that there was never a time in the history of the world when there were so many opportunities to do anything. Let's get this fear and despair out of our minds. There's nothing in the world that you can write from the standpoint of agriculture, from the standpoint of mechanism, transportation, or anything else, that we can't solve if we're willing to talk to the apparatus. Let the job be the boss. I was telling Dr. Willard about some of the maintenance things we had on these railroads. A friend of mine came over from Switzerland, and he said to me, how did you get yourself into the state of mind that you could design such a cockeyed diesel engine as that? Well, I said, my God, we didn't design the engine. All we did was run errands for it. We made a single cylinder engine, and we took the engine a half a dozen systems and said, now, will you try those out and tell us which one you like the best, eh? And we did the same thing with the valves and the same thing with the other things, eh? And so the engine picked out what it thought it liked the best, and so we built a 16-cylinder engine like that, and it did very, very well, see? And I said, I want you to show you how much smarter the engine was than the engineers. Because the ones that the engineers picked out would do about 50,000 miles on the piston. The ones the engine picked out would do 1.5 million miles. So that's a nice gain. And so the fellow was criticizing his piston. He said, well, how could you do that? Well, I said, we didn't do it. We let the engine do it. And so we set a couple of those pistons up, cut in two, at a Society of Automotive Engineers meeting in Detroit at the SAE, Society of Automotive Engineers. Some are engineers. That's the other interpretation. And we had these two systems sitting on the table there with cards up, stating exactly that one would run about 50,000 miles, the other would run 1.5 million. And I went up there one night just to listen to the loose conversation, and the fellow said, I wouldn't have that iron piston there. Well, I said, why not? Look how much better it is. He said, you can't tell me how much better it is. I can tell by looking at it. It's no good. Well, I said, how can you tell by looking at it? Well, he said, I'm an engineer. Well, I said, I know, but was you ever a piston in a diesel engine? That's the only way you can find out. But we're great in the engineering schools, great state universities like Illinois, with the wonderful facilities you have for education here, the opportunities of the people to learn, of the people to do, is simply amazing. I have only one criticism about the modern engineering and technical education, is that I think that you set a type of entrance examination that will rule the inventor out. I don't think the inventor could get into one of the schools at all. Now, I think that I can teach anybody to be an inventor. Somebody said, my God, I hope you don't do it, because... Now, the only difference between an inventor and any other person is... And I think the Brookings Institute made this study in which they showed that the more education you had, the less likely you were to be an inventor. Well, that was due to two things. Either you were a specialist, a scientist, or you had been taught from the time you went to kindergarten right on up that it was a disgrace to fail. Because if you fail once in a university, you're out. Well, in an inventor, you fail 999 times. If you succeed once, you're in. And we look upon failure as the stepping stones to get up to where the thing is. You do that in everything else. Some of you may play golf. Well, now, you go out there, and what's your chances of breaking 90 the first time you try it? Even in 18, you couldn't go out and... But what do you do? But you practice, and finally you practice. Well, the amateur golfer knows the clubs are designed wrong right away. So you have to practice. We've got to learn to do that. Not the inventor has to learn how to practice. And so we fail again until we finally learn how to do a thing. Because knowing a thing, where it is in the book, don't put it in the instrument at all. A fellow speaking of an old professor of mine, he says he knows an awful lot more than he understands. And so we have to digest this information a lot of times. So if we learn how to practice, we learn how to experiment, not cut and try, not in these bad ways, but to evaluate. By measuring these things against each other, there's nothing in the world that you can't do.